Greetings. At the end of February, I was up at CPAC in the Washington Beltway on behalf of the Civitas Institute. I interviewed policy experts and leading figures in the conservative movement for Civitalk. Coming up next, we will air a special CPAC interview from the event. Stay tuned and enjoy.
From the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Ray Nothstein, we are up here at CPAC with Larry P. Horace. He's been in the conservative movement a long time. He writes at punchingbagpost.com, and he has just been in the conservative movement a long time. He knows this movement. He's been at CPAC from the beginning. He's very influential, a prolific writer in the conservative movement. So we're happy to have a little bit of time with him today. And I just want to ask him, what does he think about the CPAC? He's been at a lot of CPACs. What's his general impression so far?
Well, I think the biggest thing is growth. I mean, we're talking, I used to say that this was the most important conservative meeting in the country, in America. I now say it is the most important political meeting in America. It has grown to have an impact actually far beyond what we thought about in those early days. We were hoping to have an impact. But when you see 10,000 people converging on one site, and you see the amount of media, the dozens of media that now from all over, I did an interview with somebody who goes into China. So this thing has become spectacular. When in the old days, when Dave Keene, a good friend, started this organization, it was, virtually 100 people in a meeting room. I mean, this was started in a very small way, as these things do, as movements do. And it continued to grow and grow and grow and grow. And I credit that to the leadership of people, the foresight of people like Dave Keene and others. And also because it's a good message. We were actually carrying the message to a receptive audience. Most people in America are right of center. If you come at them not from the political side, but from the philosophic side, and you say, what do you think about big government? They don't like big government. What do you think about high taxes? They don't like high taxes. You think we should shrink our military? No, we don't think we should shrink our military. Should we be able to go in the inner cities and educate black kids? Yeah, we should do that. So, a lot of very conservative issues, the American public are with us. But there's a disconnect on the political side. And that disconnect, I attribute to a couple of things. To be a little critical of, in a sense, my own household, Republicans have not been the best sellers of conservative principles. Some have, but we've had a lot of Republicans who, think that being Democrat light is way to, how to offer an alternative. And I've always learned and told them that if you want to be an almost Democrat, you're not going to get elected because people will go for the real thing. If you're going to be a left winger, you're not going to take an almost left winger. And so what we need, and we've been successful in run-ups. Obviously, Reagan was a big success. That was the lead up to that was what we were all about. But even now, since 2010, there's been a tsunami of Republican support. 2010, the Republicans took the House. 2012, Obama got reelected. But at the same time, governor, we picked up governorships and legislatures, and so it was a pretty good year for Republicans. Along comes 2014, we take the Senate, and 2016, we take the presidency. And we wind up putting two judges on the Supreme Court. So, we have a lot of momentum in that. Needless to say, the Democrats, the liberals, and the left-wingers are fighting back very, very hard. And they have one advantage that is a tragedy, and that is the loss of an ethical journalism in this country. I know for people who are on the hard left, they're cheerleaders. They love the left-wing journalism. But people who are objective, you know, look at it and can say, you know, when you look at a show like Morning Joe, when they have 6, 8, 10 panelists and guests, and not one offers an opinion other than the narrative. And I always call them the bobblehead panelists or the panels of parroting pundits, because you don't get an alternative view. And so we've got to really somehow re-empower the media to do its ethical job. Its job is not to be the prosecution. Its job is to be the kind of the judge in the court of public opinion. They're about to lay out the cases or listen to both sides lay out the cases. And it's so dramatic now. I never worried about the bias in the old days. It was a little bias. But there were still journalistic ethics. Now, the ethics are out the window. It's disgraceful. I mean, it's just impossible to get your head around it, how biased they are.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. One of the things, you know, I like to promote on my show and talk about it just in writing is the importance of the Fourth Estate, because we need a strong media as a watchdog in this organ, in government, and just to, you know, as a watchdog over this country, and to see them shamelessly become so partisan, I think is really disastrous for this country. It's disastrous for conservatives as well as liberals in the way that the sort of the media has fallen apart. Let me ask you another question. I believe Donald Trump's going to be here Saturday. There's a lot of conservatives that aren't here, you know, so-called conservatives, whatever you want to call them. They aren't here because they don't like Trump. And a few of them don't like what CPAC has become. You've been around for a long time. Do you have any thoughts on that in terms of kind of what CPAC is now? Then there's a lot of people that just don't like Donald Trump. And, you know, some of them, you know, maybe thought that he wasn't going to be conservative. That has turned out not to be true. But just kind of some general thoughts on some of the conflict in conservatism today, especially as it relates to Donald Trump.
Well, the first thing is I have to explain that, you know, I voted for Donald Trump not because he wasn't my first choice in the primaries. As a matter of fact, I always say, you know, out of the 16 candidates, he was my 17th choice. But the fact of the matter was when he won, which he won fair and square, he won the nomination, I had to make a choice. And it wasn't a hard choice. It wasn't a difficult one, because the alternative was so repugnant to everything I believe in. But there was a little bit of finger crossing. I said, well, you know, I'm hoping this guy, you know, turns out to be okay. Well, I have to tell you, and I've written about this, to my pleasant surprise, he has been as good a conservative president as we have had. 2 great appointments, not to the Supreme Court, and all of those appointments that nobody even pays attention to go into the district and the appellate courts, which is critically important.
Federal society's been so big.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And then you wind up with a Secretary of Education who really pushes for school choice. You wind up with empowering the military again, more budget for the military. You wind up with all kinds of things. And so why the anti-Trump press are covering the bright, shiny objects of politics every day, they're really, in a way, not informing the public of what's really happening in government. I would think a lot of liberal people out there listening to all these reports, they can get upset about alleged campaign contributions and this and that. And if you're a liberal in this country, you have no idea how Washington is being changed by conservative principles. No idea.
That's a very good point. I'm up here at CPAC with Larry Horace. He's been in the conservative movement a long time, an expert on conservatism. I want to ask him about the federal debt and spending, because it looks like nothing is happening in Washington on this issue. Really, nothing has happened in decades. I mean, I remember being a boy in the 1980s and us going over $1 trillion during the Reagan administration. And we talked about all these things like PAYGO, Graham Rudman, all these acts to control the deficit. Now nothing's happening. I think part of that is cultural, because we have so much debt with credit card debt and student loan debt that no one's really pushing Washington to a great degree too. But I would just like him to comment on the spending and debt crisis in this nation, and how do we change that narrative? How do we actually act to do something on that instead of just continually kicking the can down the road?
Well, the first thing we have to do is we have to have a fundamental change in thinking, a restoration to what is our federal system. The concept for the founders, which built this country into its greatness, was very simple. Keep the decision-making of politics as close to the people as possible. That means, as we used to say, I have a phrase, don't make a federal case out of it. The liberals have gradually put more and more into the federal government programs that never should be there. So if we were to have a magic wand, and I know politics is tough, but if we had a magic wand, we should reduce the size of the federal government by 20% to 30%. Now, the establishment and a lot of Republicans, well, we can't do that, we can't do that, we can't do that. Well, you can't do that, and you're going to visit our children with a big debt that they're going to have to pay off. Now, think about this. We're running up trillions of dollars that unborn people are going to have to pay off. That's taxation without representation, which our founders described as tyranny. I mean, how can you be represented if you're not even born yet? So it's an obscenity that we're doing that to our ancestors. We have to be able to tighten the belts and say, push this stuff back to the states. But there's very sound economics for doing that. Do you know, let's take an example. President Clinton at one time decided to send federal dollars to the states to cities to buy policemen, to hire policemen. Now, let's say you can get three policemen for a dollar, okay? If you tax at the city level, it's 90-some percent efficient. That means you tax a dollar at the city level, you can get three policemen. If you send the money to your state capital and they send it back, it's two-thirds efficient. Now you only need two cops for the dollar. The federal government is one-third efficient on a good day. That means you send the money there and they send it back, you only get one cop. So this idea that the federal government ought to be bribing our cities and our states with money that they took from the people of those cities and states at a great loss. So what we should do is we should push back a lot of programs and let the cities and state consume, be more efficient, be more inexpensive. And maybe at the city level, it would take a little more taxation, maybe. But at the same time, we have to look at the untold programs that need to be ended. One of the problems in Washington, and I live there, is that the federal government is so big, there are billions and trillions of things we could cut. But if the government is so big, we don't even know where to start. It's like, imagine yourself, somebody said, we got to cut the lawn, and you look out, and the lawn goes out for 100 miles. You say, I don't even know where to start this. I can't cut the lawn. So what we have to do, and we're going to have to do it, because the economy will do it for us. It's going to crash. It's going to become so burdensome. And we've got the examples. You can look at the old examples of the Soviet Union under communism and socialism. You can look at China. It's socialism. We call it communism, but it's socialism. China under Mao, poor countries, poverty, starvation, everything. Look at Venezuela today. The policies we are pursuing as a country in the last 25, 30 years is the roadmap to what happened to those countries eventually.
That's a great point. We've totally, I think, have lost this notion of federalism today and the importance of the 10th Amendment in empowering states, I think, to solve a lot of problems that we don't need to do through centralization through D.C. Just a very last question for Larry, who's been a great guest. And this is for some of our younger listeners, maybe people that are newer to conservatism. And you can talk about, too, where to read your work. But what might be some good resources or books for a younger conservative, someone just learning about this movement, where they can take it to the next level, maybe at an intellectual level, and really study the ideas, whether it be the founding or just the greater ideas of conservatism? What could be some good resources for a young person to look at today?
Well, first of all, they can go to Punching Bag Post and read my commentaries. why not? No, but seriously, the what I would do is, first thing I would do is I'd get on the Heritage Foundation website. They put out a lot of good publications. And it's not only just books. Sometimes it's newsletters and other things. That would be a prime good source of good, solid, conservative information. And you can even go online and, type in conservative books and come up with, you know, various and sundry conservative books. There's a lot of them, because a lot of them, it depends on, in some ways, what you're interested in. You know, if you're interested in race relations, there's some good books, you know, out there. If you're interested in the economics, there's books about that. Taxation, the military, there's no end to the books that can be. But even beyond the books, it takes a acceptance of a principle of limited government. Now, you know, ironically, one of the reasons I do all I do at my age is not for myself. It means nothing to me. I'm going to live in great America. I'll be dead before the really crap happens. So I'm doing it for my kids and my grandkids and those future generations to try in some way leave this a better world, as my parents did, my grandparents did for my parents, and we've done for 100 generations. Unfortunately, now we have a real chance and a probability, I would guess, of leaving a country not as strong as we have received it.
Great commentary from Larry P. Horst up here at CPAC. Really enjoyed the time with him today. And go read his articles. Go read his commentary. We appreciate his time. Signing off.